you ever seen the Lifetime charts one?
Yeah.
It's a parody on that.
Oh, yes, yesterday.
How'd that go, Mark?
There are quite a few rough spots as far as the overall meeting with. The homosexuals outnumbered us.
They probably said a whole lot.
In numbers, in the crowd, and in the number of testimonies. They were calling us Nazis and bigots, trying to get right wing fundamentalists.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that something? I got you there. Thanks, Mark. Was it mostly from our group that the Christians were there? Were there quite a few others from lots of other churches? Was that right? Well, if we hadn't have been there, would it really have been outnumbered? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yesterday was the public hearing for the Fair Employment Ordinance, and there were reporters from the Times and PI and Cairo on the radio. And if anyone takes the Times and PI and you see the article,
save it.
Any publications, so we know how to cover the.
Okay.
We will do.
What time
did the meeting
end?
About
12
noon.
Oh, it would have
been yesterday's
paper. They might have learned something in today. No. They'd probably be in today's then. Okay. Guess they had lots of homosexuals there.
We were the minority, yes.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that something?
Well, that's a shame, too.
Yeah, for sure.
That's what they did down in San Francisco. They started backing all the meetings and everything.
Yeah.
20% of the, or less than 20% of the people control that area.
I see, like Mark said, out of 8 people that testified, out of 12 people that testified, eight of them were from our church. So, which means that our church is doing pretty good, but the rest of the Christian community is not rallying. And lots of times they may not have known about it, but I don't know. Yeah. Okay. Today I want to continue in Dane and Manti on the article for a while, and we'll go a ways to a natural stopping point here and then go back to translating. We'll start translating in John 14. We finished chapter 3. We're going to skip up to chapter 14 now. Mark?
I don't recall whether you covered this on the tape, but on page 141, Matthew 3:3, where it says the kingdom of heaven.
Yes.
Is that an instance where you would not translate the second article?
Oh, well, he hasn't really gotten to that, you know, the Anarthrous, you know, or translating it in an Anarthrous way. I suppose this issue is primarily that of the fact that it's a genitive, the fact that it's describing something else, and in English we seldom use an article in genitives like that. So again, you get into this fuzzy area of English versus Greek, and since it's describing pretty much the quality and character, and since normally when you have the article on the noun and you'll have the article on the genitive, it's kind of carrying it through. There's the, you know, putting those things together, generally we don't translate it in an instance like this. So I don't know if he's going to specifically deal with genitives a little bit later on. I think he will. Essence of the article. Not to say that the heaven there is not definite. It's just that often in English we may not translate it that way. And whether we're right or wrong, you know, is kind of another issue. If you're going to be real literal, you know, let me put it this way. When you're doing exegesis, I'd like to, you know, if you felt it was critical to the sense of the thing, the note that it did have the article on it. But you see, generally, if you have kingdom with the article, you're going to have heaven with the article. In other words, they generally match up that way. And so the definiteness, I suppose, would be attributed more to the kingdom than the heaven. Okay, and then the context is going to affect this too. You might have a conceivable situation in which it was a particular, if there were more than one heaven, since heaven's a pretty unique term, so you don't have too much problem with that. But if there were more than one, or in the case if there was a context in which you were talking about the first, second, third heaven, and then you'd been expounding upon the third heaven, let's say, and then you said the kingdom of the heaven, you could probably be referring back up to the third one that you were talking about, not to anything in general. Okay. Price.
I have a question about contributing the article. I have a statement here by the professor of Greek at Multnomah Bible College.
Okay.
I wanted your opinion on it.
Sure.
It's very short. He says, "The article is the most tricky item in the Greek language. Only the expert is qualified to make exegetical adjustments about its use or non-use. Whenever a Bible teacher makes something out of the fact that the article appears or is absent, the listener should switch off his hearing aid because all too often he does not appreciate all the ramifications in the use of the article."
Okay. Well, I can see what he's... He's in effect, what he's saying is leave it to us elite, and we'll decide whether. But you see, the point is that he's got one point in that there are a lot of people that know only so much Greek as to be dangerous, as it were, like I've said. But they don't have they maybe just know that there's such thing as an article in Greek, and then sometimes it's used and sometimes it's not. And they may have read a rule someplace, and then they're applying that without discrimination. And so that's probably what he's reacting against. And he's probably encountered a lot of people who've taught theology and so forth and didn't have any understanding of Greek and just used enough, same with prepositions and so forth. But I think it is a bit of an overreaction. If you've gone through a Greek grammar course and seen the basic outline of things like we have here, what we're going through here, as far as principle is concerned, in Dane and Manti, for example, is about the summation of what you're going to find. If you look at Robertson and others, you might get a little bit more detail here and there, a little bit more detailed examples, but the general guidelines are going to be pretty much the same. And you're going to have to face the fact, and you'll see some admissions coming up here, that in some instances they don't know what's going on. Even the expert doesn't know that there's a solid, hard, fast rule. But there are many instances in which it's quite clear what's going on. And so, for example, in John 1:1 or something like that, where you got the article on theos and not in the other use of theos, for a person to say, see, this is kind of a cop-out thing in a way where you say, well, no, don't listen to anybody say that, especially if their theology disagrees with mine. Then we'll just say they're not qualified to speak on the subject, and then that'll end everything. And that's too extreme a position. He may have been in a circle where he saw a lot of abuse. And if he did, I can understand the statement from that perspective. If people aren't real careful, I've seen a lot of lack of care, and we've seen some things even in the textbooks, that you raise some questions about, because theology is coloring things. But I don't think I would agree with his total statement, because there are good Bible teachers that have done some reading and have done some study on this and are making these decisions. And very often what's happening is that the Bible teacher, even if he doesn't have Greek, he's basing his conclusions on a certain passage from a number of commentators and a number of experts who have all concluded the same thing on the issue. So I think it's oversimplistic, perhaps, to make a statement like that.
What would you say when it becomes sufficient enough to make comments on Greek How much knowledge did you know?
Well, I think after going through this 2-year Greek program here, for example, and especially when we're doing some translating, the kind of thing we're doing in the second year, we're starting to look at refined points. I think that with some care, you can make some comments yourself. That's part of the reason why we're giving you these research papers, so that you have an opportunity to do something like that. But I would not say we're in a position where we can now just throw away all the scholars and we can just go into our cloister and with a Greek text and we can come up with all truth. I don't mean that. However, I do mean that when you're going through and studying a number of the scholars and you're starting to see certain trends and you're recognizing, say, theological biases in certain areas and seeing differences between them and so forth, and then looking at the data yourself and examining the passages that contain the and so forth and using some care, the kind of care and principles, I don't think there's any problem. I wouldn't hesitate to make some comments and some things. And, of course, we've been doing that as we go. And that doesn't necessarily mean we're absolutely right in everything that we do, but we've got, I think we're in a position, because of the theological training and because of the kind of an orientation, the respect for the inspiration of the Scripture and a number of other things that we have, we're in a position to make some far more accurate comments. And again, remember that most of these studies are inductive studies where you're just examining how the New Testament is. As we go through, you'll see that. That flavor comes forth. They're just seeing how does the New Testament use it? And then they're just trying to carefully categorize all the ways that the New Testament uses and then draw conclusions on it. And that's what makes them scholars, as it were. It's just doing that a lot. And then learning what everybody else has done. And so all we're trying to do is learn what everybody else has done and then begin to move on. So it's going to depend to some extent upon the person's grasp of it. You know, some people pick it up more than others. But any of you that have survived this long and are in this class, you're going to be in pretty good shape as far as... I wouldn't have too many qualms about letting you begin, otherwise I wouldn't give them the assignment that I'd given, letting you chew on some of that and seeing what you come up with. So, see, after you get in and talk to some of these individuals, you find that so much of it is the theology. You know, the data and so forth we need to learn, and we need to see what the background is, but there's these elements of evolutionary origin of things, and these elements of theological bias that color a lot of what's being said and done. And if it's an issue like the article, for example, that's a stickier one than, say, you know, use function of prepositions and that type of thing. But you can still collect data and you can still see what the books are all saying, pretty much the same things on the article. There's a little bit of difference, but they're all pretty much in the same ballpark. And there will be instances in a given situation where there might be a difficulty on it, you know, like the question that Mark just asked about the genitive there and whether we translate the article or not. Some of those areas are a little bit fuzzier just because of the differences between the languages and so forth. But other areas are pretty clear, pretty straightforward and clear-cut, and regular patterns appear. And when regular patterns appear and we observe those, there's any difficulty with making some speculations on it. And they're not really wild speculations if you can find Scripture to support it and use other scriptural examples. The strength of your argument is going to be largely dependent upon whether you find other scriptural support and precedent for it. And so always keep that in mind. Just keep that in mind, whatever study you happen to be doing here for this paper, that the strength of your argument is not going to be in how many scholars you quote. It's going to be in the actual data that you find in the Scriptures. In addition to that, don't hesitate to look at the other scholars and see what you can get from them. But you may, since you find the scholars differing, what are you going to do? Decide that, well, you know, anything goes, because they all differ in opinion. If you've got some very definite opinions on it, and you see certain patterns with the theology and the understanding that you have, and certain scholars are in agreement with you and other ones are in disagreement with you, and as you examine the Scriptures over and over again, you're quite definite about your conclusion, go ahead and make your conclusion. You'll have some scholars agreeing with you anyway. Some of these smart guys that he's talking about there will be on your side, you know. So you can defer and say, oh, that's not me, it's the smart guy that says this. You see, there's a kind of an attitude, unfortunately, of scholasticism and so forth that comes. Now, I can agree with his statement to the extent that somebody who just has maybe Greek orientation or something where he just knows how to use the reference books and look up words, he might become a bit overconfident, think he knows too much. There is a lot to the grammar. But once you understand the basic rules of the grammar, have dealt with it, have done a lot of translation, have been into the Scriptures, and are honest and have a good heart to really search for truth, I think you're in a different position than what he's describing there. So he's talking about the average Bible teacher. He's not talking about community chapel Bible teachers, let's put it frankly. You know, he's not talking about people who've got a different interest. I mean, if you go out in the charismatic movement, you'll see lots of people coming and going, and some of them will talk about Greek from time to time, but you know they don't have the full range of background, and lots of times the statements they're making are statements that are selected to try to support the theological viewpoint rather than really probing in for truth. So that'd be my opinion anyway.
If you were to do a detailed exegesis on any work right now, would you just go out of the straight Greek text?
I would probably do that first, and then I would check. I would probably do some checking later if it was a grammatical point that there was some debate about. If it didn't deal with a grammatical point that there was a lot of debate about, if it was just a matter of analyzing the text and so forth, and the grammatical rules themselves were not in high question, I probably wouldn't consult them. But say it was something that was dealing with some debate about say this article use or something. If it was one of the more obscure uses of the article or one of the ones that there's more debate about, then I might do some more consulting on it. But I found that just going from the text and consulting parallel passages in the scriptures, whether they be Old Testament or New Testament, that's why it's good to have some Hebrew background as well as the Greek, so you can compare the two when it comes to dealing with constructions in both and so forth. That's what I normally do. And then I'll maybe look at commentaries and other things too. Sometimes there may be some detailed information that you're not aware of. Of course, you check your manuscripts and that type of thing too, but I feel more confident going that way and then checking later, rather than going first thing to the commentaries and seeing what everything they say, because, you know, they're useful if you don't have anything else. But when you've got something that you can start working with right away, you're subject to less bias if you just try to do it first and not really knowing what the outcome should be, and then begin to start checking the other direction. But that's what we're trying to work toward, is giving you that ability so that you can work from the text, both Greek and Hebrew, and do some exegesis on your own. And then go ahead and compare. You know, this is part of the scientific method, is verification, repetition. You know, compare it not only with other scholars, but with other brethren here that have got some similar background as you. That's one of the reasons the grad program is so helpful, is because people can bounce it off somebody else that's got some similar experience, and they might say, "Oh, well, brother, you forgot about this over here," or something. We can help one another in that area. Okay. But I really want to get you away from the kind of a fear and intimidation that happens. This happens in scientific circles too, where unless you know, everything about everything, you're not supposed to say anything about anything, you know. And unfortunately, nobody's in that position. Usually, we've got people who know more and more about less and less. You know, tell the proverbial, you know, they know everything about nothing. You know, they get that kind of specialization. We want to have some broadness here, but when you've got the kind of broadness that we've got theologically, you're in a better position to make some judgments, even about some of the grammatical things, because of the fact that theological bias does intrude into the way that many of these are doing this, and if their theology is incorrect in certain areas, it's going to color how they're going to affect the grammar. And we can try to filter at least a good percentage of that. Yes, Mark?
A good example of it was yesterday at the meeting, mm-hmm. in terms of so-called experts that they had on their side. I think they had one or two attorneys. We didn't have any on our side. And then they had two Presbyterian ministers.
In
the world, sure. You know, we didn't have any recognized ministers or lawyers on our side. They were...
So religion favors their position now because they've got two recognized authority seats. There's a real game that's put. And I'll just tell you this, too. You guys, you know, having come from Community Chapel Bible College instead of, say, Fuller Theological Seminary, you're going to be facing this thing. In other words, you're not going to have the worldly credentials. You're not going to have the big name, you know. And I've had encounters with people from Fuller and other places, and I felt like I had no problem at all, you know, in dealing with them on the Greek basis. In fact, I got accused of patronizing them and so forth, one individual. He'd gone through Fuller, you know, and but he didn't know his Greek like I was bringing it. And part of the reason was he may have learned it, but he didn't have the same necessity that... let me put it this way, it wasn't as important to him as it was to me, because he wasn't using it like we were using it. In other words, when you've got your theology all set and your denominational headquarters tell you what you believe, for what purpose are you going to be using Greek? You're not using the Greek to go in and examine theological viewpoints and raise questions and probe into new understanding and so forth, because the understanding is already set. And so it's more of an intellectual exercise, as it were, and it's really not being used all the time. And of course, when you're not using something, you forget it. And you kind of maybe went through it, but so what? Hopefully you brethren will be in a position where you are using it, you're involved in it. I would recommend that you keep your eyes in Greek, you know, for otherwise it's easy to forget some things. Take your New Testament in Greek with you to churches or whatever, and follow in the Greek. It's one way that I know of that you can keep kind of a regular exposure to it, and it'll keep fresher in your mind. But what I have to do is, in my heart, is say, Lord, you know, I'm going to learn these things, and I'm going to learn it for your sake and for your glory, and whatever credentials we have in the world will have to be established by the ministry and the anointing and the authority that God places upon us. And whether people can receive it or not, because we don't have the big name behind us, that's going to be the Lord's matter. You know, we can't say. But eventually, if you're doing a good job, and if you're faithful to the Lord, whether in this life or the next, you know, it'll be rewarded. And that's the thing we have to keep in mind. And a person could go and go to one of the big schools, and he would end up with probably a lot less. They're going to use the same books that we're using here, and they're not going to have, most of them, the same spiritual viewpoint and heart and so forth toward it. And so some of you will maybe make contact with people in this area, people that have taken Greek at SBU or this place or that place, and you'll find that the spiritual and the spiritual framework and the intensity of the interest in the study and so forth is woefully lacking. So take that for what it's worth. We want to look at these things, but we want to have a certain kind of a critical eye to recognize that there's possibilities of theological bias and so forth that are involved. This study on the article, I think, is fairly good. It's fairly free of some of the problems there. They tend to be a little bit more humble in describing the article because people have everybody's had difficulty with some certain aspects of it. Okay, well, let's continue here in page 142, and Dane and Matthew here discussing the article. Use of the article with proper names. There's some interesting features here that we began to discuss yesterday. And the first point was with regard to this first statement in section 4. Frequently, the article is used with the name of some person whose identity is made clear by the context or assumed as well known by the reader. Thus, in the New Testament, which was written for those already acquainted with the historical facts of the Christian religion, when we find Ho Jesus, we know immediately that it is the particular Jesus who was the Messiah and Savior. Okay, then in Colossians 4:11, when Paul refers to a member of the Colossian congregation who bears the name of Jesus, he significantly omits the article with Jesus and adds the explanatory phrase, olegomenos eustos. The entire phrase means a man named Jesus, but who is distinguished by being called Justice. So it's a man named Jesus, not the Jesus that the rest of the Bible is talking about, but another one who's got the same name. It is a general custom with the New Testament writers to leave off the article when an explanatory phrase is added to the name, as Saulos de ho kai Paulos, and Simon ho legomenos Petros. In other words, Saul, who is also Paul, and Simon, who is also called, who is called Peter. In other words, because the emphasis now is upon the name and upon the label rather than the identity of the person, and the explanation is with regard to the meaning of the name or something of that nature, identification that way, you're emphasizing the quality and characteristics, as it were, rather than the identity. Excuse me. In such a construction, the emphasis is upon the name as a designation rather than the identity of the individual indicated by the name. So there's kind of a rule of thumb. As we'll see in these next couple sections, though, there are some instances that get fuzzy or gets more difficult. With the name Jesus, for example, there are times when it's anarthrous and it's a little bit hard to explain why. So we'll get into that. Here's a good example here. Orkizo humas ton Yesun hon Paulos Keruse. So I adjure you by Jesus whom Paul preaches. This is what the seven sons of Sceva were saying. Now, the word Jesus has the article, and so that is by the particular Jesus whom one by the name of Paul preaches. Notice that Jesus has the article and Paul does not. And his point is that the thought of identity belongs to Jesus, but not to Paul. So we're speaking of the identity of Jesus, but it's one whom Paul preaches. In other words, or a man whom by the name of Paul preaches. In other words, they don't seem to have much personal knowledge of Paul, and they don't really have much personal knowledge of Jesus, but they know that it's a particular Jesus. It's not any old Jesus, but it's the Jesus whom Paul preaches. So you're focusing the article on the name Jesus, but not on the name Paul, because there's no real stress on his identity. It's just he's just thrown in to describe something about the name Jesus. Okay. This Roman numeral 2 here, Gildersleeve says that proper names, being in their nature particular, do not require the explicit article. And when the article is used with them, it retains much of its original demonstrative force. It is the particularizing force of the article which is employed in this idiom. Ioannes is a proper name may denote a number of individuals, but Ho Ioannes is a particular individual bearing this name. Hence, when Ho Ioannes is used, it means that a particular John assumed as known by the reader. This distinction seems in general to lie at the basis of the idiom, though it is not invariably observed in actual use. In fact, it is difficult to find a principle which will apply with uniformity to this use of the article. So they're making some admissions here Now, I think he may, Dana and Matthew, a little bit later on, are going to make an interesting comment about this, and that they're not saying that the language is just random and there's no reason for it. They're just admitting that they haven't fully discovered the reason for it yet. And I think that might be a wiser approach to it, rather than be like the medical profession a few years back when they couldn't find the use of an organ, said it had no function, it was a useless vestige of a previous stage of evolution. It might be wiser to conclude that we just don't know what it is yet, and we'll just tell you that we don't know. So I guess I'll hold the rest of those comments till later on. Weiner is undoubtedly correct in his opinion that the use of the article with the names of persons can hardly be reduced to rule. Moulton concurs by saying that scholarship has not yet solved completely the problem of the article with proper names. Thus far, we are compelled to yield to Robertson's conclusion that no satisfactory principle can be laid down for the use or non-use of the article with proper names. This is not to assume that the writer had no reason for using the article with a proper name or not using it, but that frequently we are unable to discover this reason. That's the point I was making a moment ago. It is precarious to suppose in any instance that a writer is employing an idiom at random, though in rare cases this is possibly true. So he's right in this. It's precarious to suppose that they're using things at random, especially in the scripture, especially in a book where God is trying to communicate revelation and understanding to us. Yes?
Is it possible because in ancient times there was much more stress laid upon a person's name and meaning of names, and they were more people-oriented in some respects, and here in our society we lay less stress on things and more on processes and technology and other things that perhaps were
numbers.
The kind of reason that they would
employ
for that.
Well, I think that's probably one of the larger factors involved. If you know anything about the Hebrew names, especially too, Hebrew and Greek, and of course Greek New Testament primarily because of that Hebrew background and so forth, names meant a lot more than they do to us. And the significance of names, the significance of what that name signifies with relationship to the person and the relationship to the person is far more than what we are used to today. And so because we're not used to doing that, we may be missing a lot of what's going on there, and that's, I think, what they're confessing by saying, well, we're not able to observe or perceive this rule. If we knew some more about that situation, and if we lived back in that day, we might not have the questions that we have today. We might be saying, well, you know, it's quite obvious, but it's not obvious to us now, or at least to the scholars that have done the study on it. Which means here's an area where, if any of you are so inclined, you may want to do some research or do some delving into things. We may have some insight spiritually as we grow spiritually that may help us in some of these areas. Okay. So I think his statement is good, though, that it's we are not to assume that the writer had no reason at all. Sometimes the writer's reason isn't a real big and obvious one either, just like when you're composing something and you're writing along and you decide to use this synonym as opposed to that one and this expression as opposed to that one, use an infinitive instead of a participial construction or this or that. What is it that tells you to use one or the other when you've got a couple of options? You know, it's there may not be any overwhelming reason, you just like the sound of it better. And that's something to consider as well. So we may be looking for too hard and fast, too black and white a rule sometimes too. Sometimes the reason we don't find a rule is that there may not be a black and white type of rule, but there is a reason. And there's an emphasis, there's an expression of a feeling that comes across. And sometimes those are lot less tangible, lot less susceptible to writing and explaining very clearly why this as opposed to the other. Okay, this next section deals with the name Jesus, and I think this is a good case in point. It is instructive in dealing with this problem to observe the use of the article with Jesus. The word occurs 909 times in the New Testament, according to Moulton and Gayden. It is used 359 times without the article. In 175 of these instances, the emphasis is on the messianic significance of the name, which means a deliverer. 41 times, the emphasis is upon the name as a designation rather than upon the identification of the person, approximating the force of our expression, a man named Jesus. So, in other words, these are instances in which we can see a plausible reason why it would be anarthrous if it's emphasizing the designation as a name rather than the identification of the person. That would be a reason for it, and then emphasizing the meaning of the name, the significance of the name. 10 times it is used in the vocative without the article, and so the vocative, of course, is that address, and so someone is addressing him. And if the person's right in front of you, you know, you don't really have to designate anything else. The vocative has almost got an articular sense to it, you might say, in a way, such a definiteness to it that may be the reason for it's a plausible explanation. In several instances, these anarthrous uses are in salutations, where the absence of the article is doubtless due to the general custom in the New Testament and the papyri of not using the article in salutations. Okay, so that's an observation that has been made, that frequently in salutations that you'll see no article when you might expect one. And the speculation is that that's due to the fact that expressions that are very common and used very frequently and in special modes like this lack the article just because the definiteness and everything is already understood from the construction. But there are 133 times that Jesus occurs without the article, for which we can find no evident reason. Though this is but 15% of the occurrences of the word and 34% of the anarthrous constructions, yet it is sufficient to prove that we are as yet unable to lay down any rigid principle according to which we can explain the use of the article with proper names. The anarthrous constructions of Jesus prevail in John, Hebrews, and Revelation. In John, they are mostly in the phrases Jesus said or Jesus answered. We've seen this over and over again. Apikritha Jesus ka epin auto, you know. So, and there's no article on Jesus. Most of the anarthrous constructions in Luke are in the expression Jesus said. This is probably in line with the custom of not using the article in stereotyped or technicalized expressions. So they're giving a speculation as the possible reason for a good number of these 133 here. But the point is that these admissions, you'll see them not only from Daniel Manti, but he quoted Robertson and Moulton and a number of other sources here that have the same problem. They're not able to come up with a full-blown, rigid rule for this. And that's why we've had to say from time to time, you know, it's not really clear-cut. It's not really black and white one way or the other. Maybe it is, but we just don't know yet. We just don't know enough about it yet. There's more room for more research, in other words. And some of these things, the research is going to have to take the form of perhaps a greater spiritual understanding of things and moving higher spiritually, because the access to the information that would be relevant from that time is pretty much limited. And a lot of that has already gone through. I mean, we've got papyri, we've got other things, we've got examples of writing at the time and so forth. We've got the data there, but sometimes what we're lacking is living in those times and the feel and so forth of the actual people in the times in a fuller sense. And some of those things are quite intangible. Now, of course, as far as this articular versus anarthrous use, I don't think there's any major theological issue that rises or falls, you know, with whether the article is taken this way or that way. And like anything else, you've got to take it in the light of everything else in the scripture. Okay, let's look at some other uses here, though. The generic use of the article, another fifth category here. This is the use of the article with a noun which is to be regarded as representing a class or group. Gildersleeve says, the principle of the generic article is the selection of a representative or normal individual. It comprehends a class as a single whole and sets it off in distinction from all other classes. It individualizes a group rather than a single object and points out that group as identified by certain characteristics. Well, all of that may be more difficult to understand than just the example here. Hi alopeces folius ecusin. Foxes have dens. Okay. Notice the word the foxes has the article. And so a literal translation would be the foxes have dens. Now, which foxes are you talking about? Well, you may not be talking about any specific group of the foxes over there, but the foxes as a concept, as a class. The class of animals we call foxes have dens. That's the kind of the idea. It's particularizing the concept of foxes, not one particular fox or two or three particular ones, but classifying the whole group. The class of animals we call foxes have dens. So you're making a general statement about a general class, but you're particularizing the whole class. And so it's called the generic use. The other comment here may be helpful. The thought of the entire passage here is that a thing, even as lowly and insignificant as the fox, has a shelter of a kind. But the Son of Man is humbled even beneath that lowly state. The meaning is, the foxes, mere little beasts though they are, have dens. Thus the noun is used to represent a class rather than a group of individuals. So it's the class, not the group. In other words, we're not talking about a particular group of foxes that happened to be in the vicinity at the time that they were pointing to, but we're talking about the concept of foxes. We're dealing illustrating a concept, and the article is being placed on this to indicate this whole thing as a group, the foxes. Yes.
Which would be another reason why equating the article with death is
Right. It doesn't always answer the question, because there's lots of kinds of definiteness, and in this sense, it's almost indefiniteness in a way. There's a certain depending how you're thinking of this, you're not talking about a particular fox or a particular group of foxes. You're talking about the whole class. Now there is a definiteness in the sense of you're talking about that particular class of animals as opposed to other classes of animals. So you can have a definiteness on that line, but not on this other. So there's different kinds of definiteness that we're talking about here. So we have a definite class of creatures in mind here, but it's the class now, not an individual that's being focused. So I think you've got a good point there. We're not really, the concept of definiteness per se has got to be expanded a bit, at least, in your mind, to realize that there's lots of different kinds of definiteness. Yes?
How is it less definite if it were to be an artist? It's still definite to my mind.
Well, it still would be. And the difference between those two, just foxes have dens without the article on it, it would be maybe a little bit more general statement, and you're just maybe making just a simple statement of fact, general maxim. To put the on it, it seems to deal more. It's hard to even describe it. But I sense and I think you do too. It sense a slight difference in emphasis, and maybe more of a. How do I say this? You're really particularizing this thing. The foxes have dens, and of all the animals in the kingdom in the earth, the class of animals called foxes have dens, as opposed to the simple statement that foxes have dens. We all know that. It's more of an emphasis in feeling thing than it is a substantial difference in the nature of the statement itself. Yes.
If this is true, then an anarchist use would be more fitting to his explanation, because it's like he's saying, well, the foxes, mere little beasts though they are, have dens. I mean, that's the noun used to represent a class or a group of individuals. It's just like saying, well, you know, foxes have dens, but by putting the article on it, it's like saying, now you look at foxes in particular, foxes have dens.
Right.
Well, why is he particularizing out foxes if he's just using a general statement to show that, you know, lowly animals have places to live, but then doesn't? In his interpretation, another article used would be better.
Okay. Well, no, I think the fact that he says the foxes have dens is he's picking out an animal that's lowly, and he's drawing your attention by using the article, the foxes, even something as lowly as the foxes. In other words, even those have dens, as opposed to just making a statement, foxes have dens would be a general statement that would not necessarily give any implication as to how you regarded foxes in relationship to other animals. In other words, the fox is perhaps putting the article on it, but what he's seeming to say is that you're drawing attention to the fact that they're lowly. You're drawing attention to that group, rather than saying, you know, you could have picked elephants, you know, have this or that, or different lots of other animals could have been mentioned. But to pick something lowly, pick something that's got kind of a negative reputation even, you know, for stealing the grapes and that type of thing, even the foxes have dens. Yeah. Let's see, Mark first, then we'll take
it. Perhaps maybe what we're talking about is three different classifications, because with our use of man, we can say the man, and we're talking about the particular man in most cases, or a man, and then we just talk about man in a generic use, but perhaps Greek would not use, we could use either the definite article or an indefinite article. And then we could take the middle route. But with Greek, they have either the definite article or the the town residents.
Right.
So in some senses, we have a little more flexibility.
We do have in one sense, too, because of the indefinite article. We can do a little bit that the Greek can't really do. The Greek is having to cover with the anarthrous use of the of a phrase, and sometimes even bordering into the articular, so a region that we have a separate word to cover, and that may help. Let me get you, using your example of man, we can talk about the man, a particular man that did something. The man went to the store or something. We can say that, we can make another statement that men are carnal or something like that. Or we can say that man is carnal. And in the Greek, to say man is carnal, you might see something like an articular use, even either singular or plural. The men are carnal, or the man is carnal, dealing with a conceptual thing, dealing with man as a category. Now, you could also say men are carnal as a general observation. But to say that man is carnal, see, we do the same thing. We're expressing a subtle distinction. When we're preaching a sermon and so forth, we might be in one sense saying man is carnal, talking about mankind. Another sense, we might say men are carnal. And it's really, what's the difference between those two statements? I mean, they're both getting across the same idea, but there's a conceptual difference there. On the one hand, you seem to be talking about something intrinsic and basic to the nature of the beings we call men. That's part of what is involved in their whole existence. And the other, we may be just making an observation of fact without drawing any conclusions. Men are carnal by my observation, but man is carnal is maybe making a statement on a higher plane. There's a slightly different slight distinction. I think it's the same distinction as here. Foxes have dens. The foxes have dens, as opposed to an observation that foxes have dens. It's subtle. It's really subtle, but that's what we're talking about now, is the subtle differences. And it's really hard to put in words what's the difference there. But when you read it, you will sense a difference. And sometimes you might call it a stylistic variation, but I think it even goes deeper than that into the whole concept of what's going on in the mind. You can see they're having trouble expressing it in a real clear form, too. That's why they just give you some categories and type a little bit, but leave it up to you. Okay, so this generic use, I think it's just focusing on the class of what it is. And you've got a definiteness with regard to the class of things, and you're associating it with the class of things. Whereas a statement, for example, foxes have dens, would be similar, but would have more of just the observational character to it. Yes?
That's what got me.
Mm-hmm.
seems to me that, and I think I'm right still, in the anarchist use would fit his description better, because when Jesus, I think he's way off here when he says, by saying the foxes have dens, not talking about a humble animal. You know, foxes have dens would be that kind of interpretation. When he's going to say the fox, now look at, and hold on, the foxes have dens. He's saying, what is he, you know, he's making your mind think, what does he mean by the fox? You know, I mean, he called Herod a fox, you know, and it might be a typological picture he's trying to draw. Now look at Herod and those guys, you know, they've got dens.
Okay.
You know. And so by drawing a picture of the foxes, well, what foxes is he really talking about? You know,
okay, I see what you're getting at.
Foxes have dens, you know.
But
then you also went and said that birds have nests. So,
is that hard to do? Yeah. It'd be Matthew 8:20. Why don't you check and see if the construction follows through?
In other words, you're saying this refers to. I think he might be referring to something more than just foxes, because if he just went, well, foxes have dens,
Well, what you're saying would still fit what we're talking about. If you see, the emphasis is upon the class. Is it articular in the rest of them too? The birds. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's there may be more spiritual implications, but the point is, if indeed he was talking about Herod and so forth here, in addition to the rest. The fact that he singles out the class of beings called foxes, and he would be saying that the foxes have dens, and those foxes may be four-legged ones or two-legged ones, but they have dens. In other words, the class of creatures called foxes has dens. And And because the Fox has kind of this sly reputation, so well, there may be some connections there. I wouldn't preclude that, even though he goes on to say in birds. Yeah, and is it the birds of heaven there? Okay, well, those are generally classified, you know, the birds, the fowl of the air, as it were, the birds that are the scavenger type. So there may be some symbolic things. Right. Yeah. And I don't think you need anything else other than just that statement to justify the use of the article, because you're talking about the class of things. So, you know, don't read too much into this, because the difference between with the article and without the article is not going to be a gigantic one. But it's maybe not one easy to describe, but I think it's dealing with this classification concept where you're really classing them. When you make the statement, birds make nests and so forth, you're not as particular about the classification as you are when you put the article on there. The class of creatures we know as birds, you know, have nests. Okay. With pronouns, I don't know if I'll even go through this. You're all familiar with this anyway. He's just categorizing the fact that the article is used with pronouns, and he's not so much saying that the article adds something to the use of the pronoun as much as he's saying that the fact that it's used with pronouns is something, it shows you something about the nature of the kind of a word an article is, of it showing definite, pronouns show definiteness, and articles used with pronouns, it's very appropriate. So, hutos and akenos, remember, those two demonstrative pronouns would always use the article. They were never used in an anarthrous way to modify a noun. There was an anarthrous situation, but it was not to modify a noun. And then he mentions the ordinarily used with a genitive of the personal pronoun. It's used without tos, has been discussed sufficiently under pronouns. Use of the article with pas represents important variations. We talked about pas before, and having with the article on it, you know, means the whole, as opposed to without the article, just meaning every or all. And pas whole means all. And whole passe means the whole, you know. So you've got, I think that's pretty straightforward from what we've talked about before. When you put the article out in front of the whole expression, whole passe, then what you're doing is, in effect, putting a bracket around the passe and saying the whole, or the all of something, the all of something, as opposed to all of something. So it's a slight distinction, but we've already discussed that in Getchus. I think there's nothing too much more to say there. Although I might just throw this thought in your mind, because we're going to come up to it a little bit later on. We'll get to Granville Sharps and some other things. Although we'll go into more detail on Granville Sharps later. This concept of putting brackets around something and the article framing something and putting it into brackets and designating the concept, I think, is a very useful one for understanding what the article is doing. That may even transcend the concept of definiteness in the sense of bracketing, putting brackets around something and setting it apart as a unit. And that thought's going to come up with a lot of these other uses, and especially this next one, section 7, with other parts of speech. In keeping with the genius of the article, whenever a sense of individuality is sought in any form of expression, the article is used. In such a construction, the article functions as a sort of bracket to gather the expression into a single whole and point it out in a particular way. So you may have expression that's full with a number of words, and the article stuck out on the front of that thing functions like a sort of a bracket that gathers the whole phrase together and treats it as a whole. Thus, in Luke 5:10, apo to nun signifies more than would be expressed by from the present. It means from the present as distinguished within itself, as defined by a new set of circumstances, the entrance of Jesus into the experience of those addressed. It is not just from now, but from the now. Notice nun is an adverb, not a noun. It doesn't have declensions and endings and so forth like nouns. But we've got the article being stuck on an adverb here, and behind a preposition, apo to nun, which is a very interesting expression. Normally, you know, in English we wouldn't say it like this, but from the now, and of course in the context, the now is involved with the entrance of Jesus into the experience, and Jesus has made a difference, and from now on, certain situations will prevail. So, in effect, what's happened is that the article has put the now phrase into a bracket, as it were, gathered it together into one particular concept at that time. And we'll see that that's going to be true with other whole phrases, words, and so forth as well. Is that the second bell? No, that's the first bell. Good, we can go on here for a while. Now, in Luke 19:48, Kai Uk, let's say it's rough reading. Euriskon toti poiesosin, they could not find that which they could not find what they might do, means freely rendered, they could not find the effective course which they might take. The context here is the chief priests and scribes were seeking to destroy Jesus and found it difficult because of his popularity. It is not that they could not find anything to do, but that they could not find the particular thing which would accomplish their purpose. So a literal translation of that be, and they could not find the thing to do, or the thing which to do. They could not find the what to do. So the T poiesosen would be what to do, and then you got toe on it. Usually you'll see a neuter article on a phrase like that, because, you know, how do you know whether a phrase is masculine or feminine? You know, whatever. Generally, you'll see the neuter form of the article. Neuter singular if it's a singular concept, or neuter plural ta if it's a plural concept. But they could not find the what to do. They could not find the what to do. Now, you could just say this without the article, and they didn't know what to do. They didn't. They could not find what to do. Find out what to do. But the problem is that there was a particular thing that they had to do. It wasn't just any old thing that they couldn't find what to do. They couldn't find the thing that they could do to meet their need in that particular hour, the particular thing that would accomplish their purpose. So it really particularizes that concept. This principle may apply to adjectives, adverbs, participles, infinitives, prepositional phrases, clauses, and even entire sentences. So this is something that's, I think, one of the most fun things about Greek is to see them use these articles and bracket whole sentences sometimes. Here's another example. To e dune panta dunata to pistuonti. If thou canst, all things are possible to him who believes. Now, notice this first phrase, if thou canst. You've got the article to on it. To e dune. And literally, it would be the if thou canst. The if thou canst, all things are possible to him who believes. Now, in English, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, the if thou canst. However, he says, freely rendered, to e dune means beware of the lack of faith implied in that remark, if thou canst. Of course, he's adding quite a few words to that. But in other words, he's saying, he's drawing attention to that. The if thou canst, you see, I mean, it's kind of, it's real hard to describe it. But it's drawing attention to that response that people had made, that statement over and over again that people make, if you can. And then he says, all things are possible, and then we'll believe.
Could this, like in English, maybe it's like a question, or like, if thou canst?
Yes, or either a question or an exclamation, like they put it here. You know, a kind of a surprised response to it. Maybe almost a question mark, exclamation point, you know. Picking up on what has been said, and or at least what people often say, and then saying all things are possible. Yes, Mark.
This is what the Aramaic translation is. Jesus said to him, "That expression, if you can."
Okay.
Why all things can be to one if one has faith.
Right. Okay. That's a good way to put it. That expression. So, you know, that expression, it's almost like, it's almost functioning like a demonstrative pronoun, that statement. And then you could consider this in one respect as a statement that's almost a nominative absolute construction. Just, you know, using to as a nominative article in the whole phrase as your noun and just sticking that thing, you know, in an expression like that. When we examined other uses of the nominative, looked at those statements in the nominative just stuck out there for your mind to draw attention to, and it could be in that sense too. And that way you probably just do it with an exclamation point. But it's quite a good example of what we're talking about here. But you see, what's happened is it's particularizing that statement. It's not just reiterating that statement, but it's drawing attention to that statement and putting a bracket around it. That statement, if you can, let's talk about that. See? Okay. That's the last bell, so we'll stop here. Tomorrow, let's see, tomorrow we don't have class. Next Tuesday, you've got the quiz on Wednesday. Tuesday, I think we'll start translating John 14 first and then get back to this. I think it's Wednesday. Is it Thursday? Thursday, I'm sorry.
I don't think I'll be here.
Okay. All right. Is it going to be the same thing? Okay.